From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our special guest on this edition of the program is Elliot Abrams, author of the new book, Realism and Democracy, American Foreign Policy After the Arab Spring. Elliot Abrams is also a senior fellow for Middle Eastern Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations, and we're coming to you from CFR headquarters in Washington. Abrams is a former high-level public servant, having served as Assistant Secretary of State for Human Rights under former U.S. President Ronald Reagan, and he was Deputy National Security Advisor in the George W. Bush administration, where he handled Middle East policy for the White House. In his new book, Realism and Democracy, Elliot Abrams argues that American foreign policy can combine practical politics and idealism. He sees no contradiction between defending U.S. interests in the Arab world and supporting those struggling for democracy and human rights. A leading Middle East expert, Abrams shows that deals with tyrants and autocrats simply do not work. He also argues that Islamism is an idea that can only be defeated by a better idea, democracy. In the book, Abrams analyzes America's record of democracy promotion in the region and beyond, from the Cold War to the Obama years. In doing so, he demonstrates that repression actually helps Islamists beat Democrats, while political openings offer moderates and liberals a chance. We'll talk with Elliot Abrams about his new book and to what extent the Trump administration endorses or diverges from the principles espoused. Elliot Abrams, welcome to the program.
Thanks very much. Glad to be here.
Well, thank you for hosting us here at CFR headquarters in Washington. Well, first, a basic question, Elliot Abrams. What prompted you to write this book, and now?
I think that the high watermark, in a sense, of support for democracy was George W. Bush. And it seemed to me that we were turning away from it a bit in the Obama years when I started writing the book. And we did that in part because people felt, well, democracy and human rights is fine, but we have a giant security problem, violent extremism. And that's the critical thing. We have to fight it. So, you know, democracy, human rights have to be pushed aside for a decade or two. And I wanted to make that argument that you mentioned at the outset, that actually tyranny is not a good way to fight Islamic extremism. A more open political system, a more open political debate is actually in the end going to be a more effective way of dealing with it.
Well, you did mention George W. Bush, and it's very well known that he did promote democracy. But on the other hand, some criticize the way he did it. Now, he did come in to office around the 9/11 terrorist attack on U.S. soil. That was certainly a wake-up call. And that prompted him to say the following. You probably remember this quote. Quote, in the long run, stability cannot be purchased at the expense of liberty. And again, insinuating, as you said, that for too long, the United States has pursued interests that aligned ourselves with odious autocrats who eschewed liberty and democracy and often oppressed their own populations. But the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq was highly criticized because many said, well, we cannot promote democracy, you know, at the barrel of a gun. And at the same time, you know, we note that the Arab Spring sort of followed. We saw uprisings in Egypt, in Tunisia, Tunisia first, obviously. And this was very heartening. On the other hand, Elliot Abrams, what do you say to what has happened in the aftermath of these Arab Spring uprisings, particularly unrest in Tunisia now, and much more so even in Egypt?
First, I'd say the notion that the Arab world needed a political opening was not invented by George Bush. If you go back, say, to 2002, the UN Development Program issued a thing called the Arab Human Development Report, done by Arab intellectuals, saying, what's the problem here in the Arab world? The freedom deficit. That was their term, freedom deficit. And they talked about the need for more individual freedom, more political freedom, in order for the Arab world to move forward politically, economically, socially. Bush agreed with that, but he didn't invent it. Second, I'd like to say, we did not invade Afghanistan or Iraq any more than we invaded Germany and Japan in World War II for the purposes of instilling democracy. It's wrong to say that the United States tried to promote democracy at the barrel of a gun. You know, we fought in World War II to defeat enemies. Now, once we had conquered Germany and Japan, well, we're Americans, and we believe in democracy. So we try to get them to establish democratic systems. Same in Afghanistan, same in Iraq. But we didn't go into those conflicts for the purpose of creating democracy. And the better example, the one that I like to use, is Ronald Reagan, who tried to promote democracy around the world with pretty good success, but never by invasion, never by military force. Really by what you might call ideological warfare against what was then the key opponent of democracy, which was communism.
No, I do take your point. That was more of a secondary objective with respect to Iraq, no question about it.
And Afghanistan.
Right. Well, Afghanistan having the Taliban.
Right. Well, we wouldn't have gone in, you know, if the Taliban had not been in power and protecting al-Qaeda.
Correct.
And so it was really al-Qaeda that led us to go there. But then again, you know, once the United States overthrows the Taliban, what kind of government do we want to see in Kabul? Well, of course, a democratic government. You mentioned, you know, now things don't look so great. And that's true. I mean, the one great success so far is Tunisia. In Egypt, I would say that today, 2018, the government's more oppressive than it was under Hosni Mubarak. And I would say generally that I think what we've learned is that chaos is the real enemy of political progress. After the U.S. invasion of Iraq, which was a great success initially militarily, there was really a tremendous breakdown of law and order into which a lot of very extreme groups moved. Same thing in Libya. You know, you saw chaos after Gaddafi. I think that's one lesson we should have learned from, my God, from the Russian Revolution of 1917 or the Iranian Revolution of 1979. If the forces of law and order just collapse, very often it's the worst elements, the Bolsheviks or the Ayatollah Khomeini, Castro 59, Cuba, who are able to move into that vacuum because they're well organized. One of the arguments I make for a slow but steady political opening throughout the Arab world is the forces of what we would call moderation of democracy need time to develop and organize. And too often, when a dictatorship falls, the only organized forces are, in fact, the more extreme forces that have been conspiring, sometimes in and around the mosques, while the dictators forcefully suppress liberal, including moderate and liberal Islamist groups, and don't let them organize. So they're kind of nowhere when the political opening comes.
Well, that's an excellent point. And that leads me to ask you, you know, what can the United States and the international community do to support the real Democrats, the real liberals who are squeezed between Islamists on the one hand, extremist Islamists, and autocrats on the other? Because they are the enemies of both. And we, you talked about not having enough time, that we need, you know, time in order to cultivate these groups. But we have, that is, the United States has political constraints. We never seem to invest enough time and resources in cultivating the very groups that would benefit us and their own countries.
You know, I think that's really right. It reminds me of a visit I had in the White House in about 2003 from one of the leaders of the democracy or human rights movements in Egypt under Mubarak. And she said to me, you know, I don't actually want a free election tomorrow in Egypt. I want a free election 10 years from tomorrow if you give me those years to organize, because we haven't been allowed to organize. So what do we do about that? Well, two things, I think. One is we need to protect people who are, in fact, fighting for democracy and human rights now. Very often they're oppressed, they're jailed, they're discriminated against, they're harassed, they're attacked. And we, and by the we, I mean broadly democratic countries, can undertake programs that actually help defend them. Sometimes this is pressure on the governments in question. Let that editor out. Let that journalist out. Let that NGO activist out of prison. Or, if need be, help them get out of the country for a few months to rest and think about political organizations. That's one thing we can do. Another, which we do through the American National Endowment for Democracy, through the Germans do it, through their political party foundations, the Stiftungen, the British do it, the EU does it. We can help people get trained and organized. In America, we have the Democratic Party has the National Democratic Institute. Republican Party has the International Republican Institute and the National Endowment for Democracy, helping train journalists, helping train young political activists, working with and supporting NGOs and nascent political groups to be ready when a political opening comes. And the other thing I should add, I think, is you need pressure from the top. That is, you need the president, the vice president, the Secretary of State of the U.S. to be pressuring with words, with language, those governments to allow more of a political opening. We tried this in 2004, 2005 against Mubarak, and you know, he did allow more of a political opening for a few years. And I think governments are very often sensitive to American public and private pressure. And when we can join together with others, so it's not American pressure, it's American, Canadian, Australian, Japanese, French, British, German, it can have an impact.
Before we go to a break, a quick question with respect to elections. It seems to me that we too narrowly define democracy as elections. In other words, as if elections are the panacea. But we know from the example you gave of this woman who said, we'll have elections in 10 years, that elections do not a democracy make. And yet that is how we, that is the United States, seems to be defining democracy. But we're having elections in places where rule of law is weak, where civil society groups are weak, and they are so essential to a true democracy. So we see trappings of a democracy with elections, but then we see, I recall back in 2005, we had elections in the Palestinian territories, and Hamas came to power. Well, they probably should never have been qualified or allowed to run in the first place, having had an armed wing.
Well, I would say elections are a necessary but not sufficient condition for the move to democracy. You can't have democracy without free elections. But any democracy around the world will always have, as you say, more than elections. You'll have constitutional protections. You'll have free and independent courts of law. You'll have freedom of speech. You'll have freedom of the press. You'll have freedom of assembly. You'll have a system that is much broader than, if you will, just elections. I think we tend sometimes to concentrate on elections because, you know, in a certain way, they're easier. They take place on one day. We know how to monitor elections. We, the international community, are very good at it. If you call an election tomorrow in country X, the EU's ready, the Americans are ready, the Australians and the Japanese and Canadians, you know, we all know how to monitor elections. And I would say also that the concentration on elections is right in that when governments steal elections, people notice. And it does tend to have an impact on the whole political system because citizens know that's a fraud. That's a fraud. That's a phony. But without abandoning the absolute need to concentrate on free elections, we do clearly have to expand in the United States and other Western democracies, in Japan and other democracies outside of the West. It's clear that you have a whole infrastructure of institutions, not just elections.
We'll have more in just a moment, but first, you're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our special guest is Elliot Abrams, Senior Fellow for Middle Eastern Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. He's the author of a new book, Realism and Democracy, American Foreign Policy After the Arab Spring. And we're coming to you from CFR headquarters in Washington. I'm Carol Castiel, and this is a reminder that our Press Conference USA podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA and connect with us on Facebook. Here's a shout out to Mobalaji Oladende. He's from Ogun State in southwest Nigeria. If you want to hear your name on the air, please write to us at pcusa@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, back to our special guest, Elliot Abrams, talking about his new book, Realism and Democracy, American Foreign Policy After the Arab Spring. Well, let's turn now to foreign policy and democracy promotion, or the lack thereof, under the Trump administration. Elliot Abrams, your book comes out at an interesting time because now we have a president who is not a big proponent of promoting democracy, it seems. We're in the era of what is called America First. Mr. Trump has emphasized counterterrorism and American economic advantage in foreign policy, the so-called America First policy. well, in a sense, downgrading some of these traditional U.S. foreign policy priorities, such as promoting human rights, democracy, and international development. To what extent do you think this shift is doing damage to U.S. credibility around the world, particularly with the very Democrats and, you know, liberal-minded politicians that you say we need to support more than ever?
Well, I have to say first that I think the Obama administration began this trend. In the American political system, presidents tend to come in and think, well, the guy who came before me was no good, and whatever he was doing, I'm going to do something different. And so Bush, freedom agenda. I think Obama came in thinking, oh, I'm not going to do that. And I think if you look at, just take the example of Egypt, what was the Obama human rights policy regarding Egypt? Not much. I think this is generally true, that the Obama administration significantly downplayed the question of human rights. There was no human rights policy, I would argue, in the Obama years with respect to Iran, because the president wanted the Iran nuclear deal. So in a way, this Trump policy is a continuation of this downplaying of democracy and human rights. The argument I would make to the administration is I understand the motivation, which is we have other very significant national interests, and the key one is defeating Islamist extremism, first defeating the Islamist State. The argument I would make is I get that. Islamist extremism is a set of ideas. You mentioned it in your introduction. Ideas. How should we live? How should the government be organized? In Muslim countries, what does God want of us? What does the Quran tell us about justice, about politics, about the nature of our society? And extremists come up with answers, of course, that we think are wrong. But a policeman or a soldier can't win that debate. The society in an Islamic country is going to have that debate. And, of course, we have our views about who we'd like to see win it, more moderate people. That has to be a political debate among various political forces. Again, cops, policemen with truncheons hitting you over the head can't win that debate. They can beat you up. They can jail you. They can even shoot you, kill you. But that won't win the debate permanently in that society. So my argument is, just as Ronald Reagan came to the conclusion that oppression, tyranny of right-wing dictators was not the way to defeat communism, I believe the United States should have the same view of Islamist extremism. Tyranny is not the answer. The answer is debate. The answer is debate among Muslims in which more moderate forces and argument, as in Tunisia, will win. And what we see in Tunisia is a robust debate, which is leading people to a kind of consensus for an Islamist democracy. Some Tunisians are secular, are much more Islamist, but they all seem to be agreeing more and more on having a form of democracy. I mean, that's the kind of outcome we'd like to see. So that is my argument for the Trump administration, and I think it's a mistake, as it always is, in my view, for the United States, to conclude that the promotion of democracy should be, you know, way down on the U.S. agenda.
Picking up on what you said with respect to the Obama administration, there's no question that Mr. Obama was trying to do, in a sense, almost the opposite of George W. Bush. He downplayed promotion of democracy, even with respect to Iran, having focused almost exclusively and very laser-like on getting the nuclear deal. On the other hand, let's look at the Trump administration. As you said, almost following in the footsteps on Iran, Mr. Trump rightly called out the regime with the most recent repression in the streets. But at the same time, we have restriction on Iranian immigration to the United States, a ban. So there's a mixed message there. With respect to routing the so-called Islamic State, that isn't enough, that we have to fight the ideology. We're seeing that as well, particularly with respect to Iraq and Syria. So we have the United States almost having defeated the so-called Islamic State in Syria, but we are allowing the Assad regime back to the hilt by Moscow and Tehran to sort of take the upper hand. How do we, you know, get out of this vicious cycle? Because we are not benefiting by not, in a sense, combating the other side of the coin that both promotes autocracy and political Islam or extremism.
Yeah, well, I think here's the problem. In some cases, what we're talking about is a kind of ideological conflict. In the case of Iran, I mean, there is one internally in Iran, I think it's pretty clear that the people of Iran hate that regime. Whenever they get a chance to rise up against it or vote against it, they do. We see this argument in a lot of other countries as well. But in some places, there's now a physical struggle. For example, Islamic State. Once it existed and was killing people, you know, we're beyond the ideological struggle at that point. Either you fight or you don't fight. And the United States and a number of other countries said, no, this cannot be permitted. And to this day, the United States is present in Syria fighting to defeat the Islamic State. And there are other examples of this where you just have to say, look, they've taken up arms, so we have to take up arms.
Exactly. But it's the follow through. It's fighting the ideology that we don't seem to be very good at, but which is essential to get to the point that you're arguing.
Well, you know, we have a problem here in the United States. This is a secular republic, and it's the vast majority of people here, I don't know, 90% are Christian. So the argument, the debate among Muslims is not really our debate. Occasionally, presidents, including President Bush, will make a statement about Islam. Remember, Bush used to say Islam is a religion of peace. I always thought he shouldn't say that because he's not a theologian. He's the president of the United States. He shouldn't be making comments about what Islam is or isn't. He's not an imam. This is really a debate that has to be among Muslims.
Exactly. But on the other hand, Elliot Abrams, I'm not talking about Islam and its various interpretations, which one can quibble with, just like with Christianity. There's evangelicals on the other side. They do not speak for all Christians. Neither does the Wahhabi doctrine in Saudi Arabia, you know, speak for all Muslims by any means. Mm-hmm. It's a very narrowly defined. But I'm talking about Islamist extremism. In other words, the Islamic State, it's a thuggish group that uses Islam for violent ends. How do we, you know, help to combat that ideology? Because that is what's going to be fueling more violence.
Well, there's one thing the United States can do, and we're doing it. They gained a lot by winning. I mean, they had an argument that, you know, we are the true Muslims. God is on our side. And, you know, initially the first, 18 months, they grew and grew and grew, and they conquered more and more territory. They established a state. They talked about a caliphate. And so if you were, you know, a Muslim sitting someplace in the world, you look at this and say, well, maybe they do have God on their side. They keep winning and winning and winning. The job of the United States was to say no. Now they're going to start losing. So if they're losing and losing and losing, I would think a lot of observers would say, well, that sort of bloom of success is gone. And they're not going to be able to recruit when it seems that they're losing and losing and losing. That's something the United States can do. That's force of arms. In the debate about whether their view of Islam is a correct and originalist view of Islam or is a heresy, you know, the government of the United States has nothing to say. I mean, that's something that Muslim scholars, particularly Muslim clergy, have to talk about. I mean, that's their responsibility.
Elliot Abrams, back to how the United States and other democracies can truly help in the medium and long run Democrats around the world, the types of people who will not only benefit their own countries in the Arab world and elsewhere, but also strengthen the United States mm-hmm. and democracy around the world. What specific steps do you recommend?
Well, the last chapter of the book recommends a bunch of things we can do. Number one, ideally, the president, vice president, secretary of state of the United States talk about this because their pressure, public and private, is important. I think we need to support and defend political actors in non-democratic countries. They're the people taking the risks and very often suffering because of it. We can help them directly and indirectly. We can try to protect them. We can try to intervene with the governments in question to get them out of jail or out from under arrest. We need to spend money on this. We need to have a budget for this. And Congress has been pretty good about this in the United States. Even when, for example, the Obama administration actually recommended a cut in the National Endowment for Democracy budget in Washington, Congress did not go along. So, I mean, by comparison with the overall budget of the U.S., this is tiny. But we have to make sure there are funds available to these various institutions to do this kind of activity. I would like to see us support political groups more than just civil society organizations, because I think the civil society organizations sometimes are more linked with their funders in Paris, London, Washington, than they have deep roots in the society. And political groups know, you know, we got to get votes. So we've got to go out in the countryside and get support. So I have a kind of a series of recommendations as to how the United States can be more effective in doing what we do. And again, it's worth saying this is not some kind of American project. Democracies around the world should be doing this and are. And whatever the U.S. is doing, the effect can be magnified many times over if you find other democracies engaged in the same activity.
Are you concerned that if we don't do this, and we have now an administration that isn't inclined to really go in this direction, that other nefarious actors who have no interest and have no real rule of law or democracy, such as China or Russia under Vladimir Putin, that they will step into the breach as they seem to be doing?
Absolutely. I think we're seeing that already. I think we're particularly seeing the Russians intervene in various places. And it is a form of political or ideological combat. They have a model, and they're pushing that model against the democratic model that's ensconced in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights at the United Nations and many international covenants on political and civil rights. If the United States doesn't lead here, I think that there's a morale question for Democrats around the world. And there are practical questions about the conditions under which they struggle against tyranny. But, you know, I always remember a phrase of Condoleezza Rice when she was Secretary of State of the United States in the second term of George W. Bush. She said, you know, democracy is never imposed. Tyranny is imposed. And I think that's right. The problem is that if we don't resist, if we don't organize to resist, the people who are pushing or defending tyranny, and that includes the Russians today under Putin, and it includes China today under Xi Jinping, they will have more victories than they deserve.
Exactly. And that's, I think, what many of our friends around the world who are either in jail, journalists, political activists, that they're afraid of. So, again, I feel like we're going sort of back, regressing, not only the United States, but even European countries, some of whom have withheld criticism of even the current situation in Tunisia, which, as you said, is improving, but it's also tenuous.
Yes, so, it is. It is. Well, I think it's, you know, there's a vast international movement in support of democracy, but if the United States is not in a leading position in it, not alone, but in a leading position in it, of course it suffers. It suffers from reduced morale and reduced political impact. So I'm hoping, you know, in the first year of the Reagan administration, going back into history, there wasn't a lot of enthusiasm about human rights, which was viewed as Jimmy Carter's issue. But as the years went by, Reagan became more and more active and enthusiastic because he became clearer to him that this was a critical job for the United States. So he made, in 1983, he established the National Endowment for Democracy. And I'm hoping that the Trump administration, which is after all only about a year old, will move in this direction as well.
The book is Realism and Democracy, American Foreign Policy After the Arab Spring. The author, Elliot Abrams, Senior Fellow for Middle Eastern Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. Elliot Abrams, thank you so much for your time and terrific insights.
You're very welcome.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Rebecca Ward for booking our guest. Our engineer was Gary Jaffe. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.